Hello and welcome to The Tidal Year, the podcast that discovers the joys of swimming. My name is Freya, and joining me this week is Leif Bersveden, a botanist and the author of Where the Wildflowers Grow. He joined to talk to me about aquatic plants, where to find them, and how to care for them. Enjoy! Before we dive into this episode, I'd like to thank today's sponsor, Tryhard. I love being in the water, but I don't love what pool chemicals like chlorine do for my skin and hair. Tryhard develop water sports specialized skin and hair solutions that eliminate those negative effects of pool chemicals and ocean salts. I'm thrilled to share with all listeners of The Tidal Year a very exclusive 15% off when you use code TIDAL at tryhard.co. Thank you so much for joining me. Firstly, I've got a bit of a simple question, but can you tell me what a botanist is?
Yeah, absolutely. So a botanist is basically, in my opinion anyway, is anyone who takes the time to take notice of and look at our wild plants. I think a lot of people think it's like a professional thing, and you certainly can have professional botanists, you know, people who work at actually studying the plants in a sort of scientific way. But I think it extends more generally to people who just go out to look for plants.
Well, I guess that means I'm a botanist then. I didn't even know.
Exactly. Yeah. There are lots of botanists all around the country who don't even know they're botanists. So.
And when did that interest start for you? Was it as a child, or did it become more academic? Have you always been interested in being outside and looking at things?
So, yes, I've loved nature my entire life. My dad got me into it when I was sort of, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years old. He used to take me bird watching in the winter, and in the summer he made this like a sweep net. So he got like an old coat hanger, twisted it into a ring, an old bed sheet which formed like the net, and then like a broom handle. And we used to go and sweep this through the long grass behind the house, collect all sorts of like insects and spiders and things, put them in little jam jars and take them back to identify before releasing them into the garden. And yeah, I just swiftly became obsessed with anything that moved, animals. I just absolutely loved them. But as a kid, I used to get so frustrated all the time because, you know, these things I loved that I wanted to look at, whenever I got within a few meters of them, they would generally just run away or fly away. And it just annoyed me so much because all I wanted to do was give them some love and time and attention. But yeah, obviously the plants couldn't do that. They couldn't run away from me. So yeah, I started noticing them. And for me as a kid, the best thing about them was that they didn't move. And I think these days a lot of people think, oh, plants are boring because they don't move. But actually, for me, that's the thing which is really, really great about them, because I can spend time looking really closely at them and working out how they live their lives, and actually get to sort of spend time with them and form like a connection with them that you don't necessarily get, at least not straight away, with a lot of animals. So yeah, I've spent, you know, the vast majority of my life so far just in love with the world of nature generally, but with a specific focus on plants.
Oh, that's so interesting to hear. And you've totally reframed how I interact with nature, because I love birds. I think there's something so magical and wonderful and colourful and interesting about them. But you're right, you can't get up close. So lots of what I know about them is through images or film. And the thought that actually with plants, you can really get up close and you have smell and texture and touch actually means that it's a really interactive and intimate part of nature as well.
Yeah, and they're like, I think that one of the things that really got me was realizing that I had this group of organisms that have to face all the same challenges on a day-to-day basis as animals do. So they've got to put food on the table, they've got to reproduce, they've got to, you know, make sure they don't get eaten by predators. But obviously, unlike most animals, they have to face that, all those challenges with the added complication of being rooted to the spot. And just that realization that, you know, I was aware of all these ways that animals deal with living in the world, but the realization that plants have to deal with those challenges, but in a completely different way, because they obviously can't just like run under a bush when it gets a bit hot or go in search of water when they get thirsty. So yeah, to have this group of organisms that have come up with a complete new suite of adaptations and ways to live in the world, it's just so cool. And they've done it in the most amazing ways. And we never get to hear about that. We tend to assume, we have this like mindset in society that plants are boring, which is like the bane of my life, because it's just something which I've just been aware that is not true for such a long time. But, you know, we tend to think, you know, they don't move in the same ways that animals do. They're all kind of green. So let's think about something else. But actually, that mindset acts as a barrier to learning about all the amazing ways they live their lives, all the incredible stories that they have to tell. And yeah, it's something, they're a group of organisms that I think need a lot more attention. They're so important. And I think people would find them really interesting if they gave them a bit more of their time.
No, you're so right. And actually, following your Instagram has done that for me, because I love flowers, but there's a lot of different plants that I don't think of as being beautiful or interesting, and that I now know to look out for because you've highlighted them to me. But I'd love to talk more about adaptations, because that's interesting. Is, I guess adaptations is something that happens over hundreds and hundreds of years, but are there any particularly that you can think of, you know, in the UK that are really interesting and cool that might be good to share?
Yes. Oh my goodness, where do we start? Well, if we're thinking along the lines of water, which I know you like to talk about, so a couple of years ago, I kind of discovered aquatic plants. I already knew about them. I knew that they existed. I'd read a lot about them. I had seen them, you know, in ponds and stuff in local woodlands, but I'd never really stopped and thought about how these plants live their lives in water just the whole time. So yeah, a couple of years ago, I had this brilliant day on the Norfolk Broads and just like exploring this fen. So this is like wetland that was full of ditches and ponds and lakes and things. And yeah, just came across some of the most remarkable plants that I've ever come across in my life. To give you a couple of examples, we had things like, so there's this plant called Water Soldier. Now, Water Soldier, it like floats on the surface of the water, basically, and it looks like the spiky leaves of a pineapple, just like sticking out of the surface of the water. And it's able to float on the water because its leaves are full of these like air pockets. And each air pocket is just like, yeah, it's pumped full of air, and that makes the plant really, really buoyant. And it just floats on the surface of the water and like dangles its roots down into the silt at the bottom. Now, you know, over the course of the summer, it photosynthesizes, it makes itself food using the sunlight. But towards the end of the summer, as the autumn arrives, it starts to break those leaves down to sort of save energy over the winter. And one of the big problems it has to face is dealing with winter ice. Because obviously if you're a plant and you're floating at the surface of the water and your pond freezes over during the winter, then all your leaves are going to get completely destroyed by that ice. And so it has to deal with this problem. So what it does is it breaks its leaves down, or like some of its leaves down. And as they break down, those air pockets collapse one by one. And as they collapse, they slowly fill with water. And so over the course of the autumn, as these leaves are breaking down, this plant starts filling with water and becomes sort of heavier and heavier, or less and less buoyant, and just slowly sinks down to the bottom of the ditch or the pond that it's in. So it hits the bottom, it gets to winter, the pond freezes over, and that actually insulates the plant, so it's a bit warmer, comparatively warmer anyway. And yeah, it just kind of sits there over the course of the winter, just biding its time. But the really cool bit is in the spring. So as the spring arrives, obviously the ice melts and the plant starts growing new leaves. The places where it grows are very shallow bodies of water, so light can penetrate all the way to the bottom. So those new leaves start photosynthesizing. They produce oxygen as a waste product, But instead of releasing that out into the air for us to breathe, they trap that air in these brand new air pockets in these new leaves. And so very slowly over the course of the spring, this plant gets more and more buoyant again, and it just sort of slowly floats back up to the surface. So it's just mad. You've got this plant that, to deal with this problem of winter ice, just, you know, sinks during the winter, lets it be icy. As soon as it's melted, it just floats back to the surface again. I just love that there are plants that do that sort of thing, that just get around this problem of not being able to just, I don't know, leave the pond for the winter, or like run away, fly away, whatever. Can't do that. So we're going to come up with some other solution. So that's brilliant. That was a brilliant plant. The other one of my favorites in that same sort of environment is one of our carnivorous plants. So a plant that basically likes to grow in environments that are very, very nutrient poor, but they need some nutrients. And one of the key nutrients that plants need is nitrogen in very small amounts. So in order to get some nitrogen, this plant, which is called a bladderwort, basically eats animals, because there's very little nitrogen in the environment that it can take up. There's a lot of nitrogen in proteins in animals. So yeah, it eats insects and things to get that nitrogen. So what it does, it's basically like, it's like a botanical jellyfish. So it doesn't have roots. It's not rooted in the ground. It just floats in the water, and the wind blows it around its little ditch or pond, and it just sort of scoots around the top of the water, just hoovering up all these little aquatic invertebrates in the water. But the way it does it is really sophisticated. So from the edge, all you can see on the surface are these sort of 15 centimeter tall red stalks with like a yellow flower at the top. Beneath the water, they have these huge, like, I don't know, 30 centimeter long sort of feather boa leaves. They're really like plumed and feathery and just hang in suspension in the water. And within those leaves, there are what look like air bubbles, but these are actually little traps, which are called bladder traps. Now, to a little insect, they look like air bubbles. They're kind of very innocent looking, but they're kind of like a lidded pot about the size of a pea. And what the plant does is it sort of empties those traps. So it pumps out any water in them, any bit of insect, any bit of silt, any air, everything goes, and it creates this little vacuum inside those traps. And there are a couple of little hairs at the entrance to the pot. So our little insect, let's say a water beetle, is wandering through the leaves. It's, you know, it's a beautiful day. It's having a great time. It's surrounded by these beautiful little air bubbles. Just having a great time. And it nudges on its little wander these two little hairs outside this entrance to the trap. And that tells the plant there's something there to eat. And so it opens the trap. That vacuum needs to be filled. So the water rushes in, dragging that water beetle with it. And the trap snaps shut again. That all happens in like a thousandth of a second. So it's the fastest known movement in the plant kingdom. It's just, you know, it's so fast that even if you don't blink, you'll probably miss it. And within, yeah, a fraction of a second, this water beetle has been sucked into this trap without being able to do anything about it. Once it's captured its prey, the bladderwort has to obviously then eat it. So the trap walls are lined with bacteria in the same way that our own intestines are. So the bacteria start breaking down this water beetle. The plant helps it out by releasing digestive enzymes, which again help break down the sort of soft, juicy, fleshy bits of the beetle, and creates this basically like a beetle soup within that trap, which it then drinks through the walls of the trap, uses all those nutrients to grow. And then within half an hour, it's pumped everything out again and reset itself, ready to catch something else. So it's just this, like, it's so clever and it's so ingenious. And this is just how it survives in one of these environments where there are very few nutrients. And it's so few people know that we have carnivorous plants in this country. And we have about 13 different species. And, you know, they're the same people who are like, oh yeah, plants are boring. And it's so frustrating because I think I would challenge anyone to see that and learn about that and then say plants are boring. because I just think that's amazing. There's a plant eating animals. It's eating animals.
You've certainly persuaded me, because plants are clearly very cool. And it's almost like, you know, when you're kids and you're collecting Pokemons and they have all these cool powers. Well, actually, we have all of that in the plant world.
Yeah, yeah. Nature is just real life Pokemon, yeah.
We need to start that as a card game.
Yes. Yeah.
And I know you went on your own adventure, traveling around, finding all these amazing plant Pokemons. Tell me a little bit about your adventure and your journey and your beautiful book.
Yeah, so I basically decided that, or I sort of realized as I was growing up that there was no real link between any initial engagement with botany, like through social media or maybe through a talk or something. So the sort of next step from that was the identification guides, which are obviously full of Latin names and botanical jargon and thousands of species, and they can all just be extremely overwhelming, as wonderful as those books are. And so I wanted to kind of write a book that bridged that gap, that sort of engaged people's emotions and got people really excited about plants before they then dive into the identification guides. So yeah, basically, you know, we're all human, we all feel things whether we like to admit it or not. And for me, when I'm out in, you know, looking at nature and plants specifically, I just feel so much joy and excitement at doing so. And I just wanted to find a way to share that and all the amazing ways that plants live their lives to try and, yeah, just get people excited about them. So I went on a big adventure 2021, literally from the 1st of January all the way through to New Year's Eve on my bike, as well as the train. I always say it's on my bike because I spent most of it on my bike, but it makes it sound like I cycled all around the country, which definitely isn't true. And there was a lot of hoiking my bike on and off of trains as well. But yeah, basically, I wanted to go on this big journey through the seasons to try and capture like 1 year of British botany and all the incredible spectacles that happen year round, you know, not just during the spring and summer. And yeah, along the way, I met with all sorts of incredible people who had some kind of connection to their local flora. And I went plant hunting with them and just chatted to them about, you know, why they like looking for plants. And over the course of the year, I tried to capture as much of our flora as possible. So all the common things which people have probably heard of, like, you know, daisies and buttercups and dandelions, and through to the really, really exciting stuff like the water soldiers and the bladderworts that do all these, you know, incredible things to live and survive. And then the sort of more landscape scale botanical spectacles, like the flowering of the bluebells and the bluebell woods and poppy fields and wildflower meadows and that kind of thing. And just trying to show how, or capture how, plants can completely transform landscapes when they come into flower. So it was really an attempt to, I don't know, write a book that would act as a gateway into the world of British and Irish plants and share all the excitement and the joy to be found here at them. And it's been out for nearly a year now. And yeah, I hope it's having that effect.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful, beautiful book. And it's really interesting because you've kind of identified something I didn't know was a space that kind of there was this book that was waiting for, because I remember having been out in Cornwall and just seeing amazing all of the purple and pink on and yellow on the coastal path. And I wasn't expecting it to be so colourful up there. And so I went into a secondhand bookshop and tried to find a book about plants. And I don't know anything about plants or wildflowers. And I got a little pocketbook, which was waterproof, which was very handy. But I kind of didn't end up using it much because it did feel quite intimidating. And it made me feel a bit like I didn't know anything, and it wasn't organized by color or area. It was like alphabetical and had all these Latin names. And I think if anything, I had this moment of spark and curiosity that I think just by having not the right tools meant that I didn't kind of go forward with it. And actually, I think having that interest and having a book that shows you that plants is for everybody is really important, because I think people get put off that they don't know enough to be into plants.
Yeah. It's so true. And it's, I think one of the things I always try and emphasize is you really don't need to know anything about what plants are called. You don't need to know their names, as nice as it is to do so. You don't need to know anything about them to appreciate them and enjoy them and notice things about them and notice how they're living their lives. So yeah, I just wanted to try and capture that, really, because, you know, there's so many wonderful things out there and just doesn't matter if you don't know what they're called.
Yeah, you're so right. And I find it actually a really good way to live in the seasons more, because, you know, somewhere that I swim quite regularly is the Hampstead Heath Ladies Pond. And when I notice the leaves going different colours, when I notice the mandarin ducks are appearing for the first time, I know it's kind of December and January is not far away, or noticing the different flowers on the riverbank, it kind of reminds me of, oh, when this was happening last year, where was I in my life and how much has changed? And it's such a great way to feel connected to life and nature. And also think it's a way to access joy. I'm really pleased you use the word joyous, because I think that's a lot about what nature gives you. I remember seeing one of your posts on your Instagram that was about meadows, and it was like a great way to feel joy is like go and lie in a meadow, and it's a completely free thing you can do, and you can go and lie and hear like all the sounds around you and the colors. And I thought, that's very true. I would feel maybe a little bit embarrassed to do that. And isn't that interesting that that's something that's available to all of us? And when we become adults, we just don't play in nature like we did when we were children.
I know. It's so strange that our society sort of teaches us to be embarrassed about doing that. And I get it. You know, when I was a teenager, I was like mortally embarrassed about, you know, being discovered looking at nature. Whereas now I just throw myself into it, and any interaction with a stranger who comes up and asks what I'm doing is just, or if I'm okay, is just a good opportunity to talk about it with someone new. I always get people coming up to me being like, are you okay? You're just like sprawled on the ground in a weird position, like just checking if you're all right. Yeah, it happens all the time. But I think lying in like a meadow or something, it's such a wonderful experience. And what my favorite thing to do is to basically imagine what life would be like as a little insect, like a little bee. Imagine the landscape of a meadow, but on the scale of as if we were the size of a bee. And imagine walking through a meadow where you've got like buttercup flowers the size of trampolines, just like way up in the sky. And like all these, like the world would just be completely different. And yet we've got that. We've got that in our lives, just on a much smaller scale. And I think there's a lot of joy to be had from sort of tapping into that childlike imagination. And it's just, yeah, it really adds so many layers to the way that we experience the world. So yeah, I think getting down on the ground in a meadow, any bit of grass and is, or any habitat at all, really, is a really wonderful thing to do.
Oh, wonderful. And now that we're in spring, we're approaching summer, what kind of plants can we be looking out for while we're swimming, whether that's in rivers or in the sea? On your adventure, what were some that you just thought were beautiful and resilient and fascinating?
So I can give you various examples. So I'll start with rivers. So one of my favorite plants along riverbanks is called hemlock water dropwort. And it's a plant that gets a lot of bad press sometimes because it's one of the most poisonous plants in the country. Don't let that put you off, though, because it's an incredibly beautiful plant. It can grow to sort of 1 to 2 meters tall, maybe 1 to 1.5 meters tall. And it has these beautiful sort of, I don't know, coaster-sized, umbrella-like flower heads that are just full of white flowers. And they look a bit like things like cow parsley and hogweed, if you're familiar with those. And they, yeah, grow along riverbanks. They love getting their little roots wet. And for me, they're a beautiful plant. They're incredibly important for insect life. But they also have this really cool thing about them where they're incredibly poisonous. And they have, their roots look a bit like parsnips, but do not eat them because, yeah, they're full of this sort of neurotoxin, which does all sorts of horrible things and can kill you very quickly. But yeah, it's one of the most poisonous plants in the country. But that's a really, really cool one that I love to look for by rivers. When I'm swimming in slow flowing rivers, but also places like, you know, locks and lakes and things. I love, one of my favorite things to do is swim with water lilies. In the same way that I love getting down on the ground and immersing myself in a meadow and sort of putting myself into their environment and sort of seeing what life is like for them, I get so excited when I find like a lock full of water lilies, because it's such a good opportunity to, well, A, go for a swim, but B, just to, yeah, to you get a better idea of what life is like for them. And to swim through, say, yellow water lilies, and actually, you know, you can get more of an appreciation of how big the plant is, because these plants are huge. We obviously only see the leaves and the flowers on the surface, but they're huge plants going all the way down to the bottom. And it's just a really special experience. And you actually get to, again, get up close to these things, which are normally so inaccessible because they're in the water. But if you actually get in the water, then you can get really close. And, you know, yellow water lilies are amazing. They're these beautiful yellow flowers. They're really weird. They look very sort of primitive. They don't really look like a normal flower when you look into them. They smell kind of like, I don't know, gone off alcohol. And they've got this weird sort of, they apparently smell of brandy, but it's this weird sort of almost fermented smell. They do this cool thing with their seed pods where they pack their seed pods full of air. So when they're ready, they sort of float off on the water, and after a certain period of time, the air pockets break down and the seed then sinks to the bottom to grow its new water lily. So yeah, yellow water lilies. We also have white water lilies here in this country, which are both very common and will grow in slow moving rivers, canals, ponds and things. I also, one of my favorites, I know I've probably said this about every single plant, but they're also brilliant. In slow moving rivers, you'll often get things like water crowfoots, these sort of aquatic buttercups. They've got five petals and they're white with a little bit of yellow, like buttercup yellow at the base. So they've got a yellow center and mostly white petals. And things like river water crowfoots, their leaves aren't sort of a typical leaf. They're just like a long ribbon like streamer. And so you get these rivers, just really, really, really healthy rivers are just full of water crowfoots. And you can see the otherwise invisible currents of the water because the leaves move with the currents. And so you can see where the currents are flowing. But again, you just get that real sort of immersive experience where you've got like damselflies and stuff zipping around your head, landing on all the flowers. Again, you get a sense of how big these plants are beneath the surface of the water. So yeah, water crowfoots are great. In the sea, so the saltiness of seawater is toxic to most plants, but there are a group of plants called seagrasses which have adapted to life literally growing in the sand, underwater, in the sea all the time. They are an unbelievably important group of plants. They're not grasses. They sound like grasses, seagrasses, but they're not grasses. They just kind of look like them. They've adapted in the same way. Growing in the water, they need to be flexible with obviously waves and stuff coming in. So they've developed these like very flexible grass-like leaves. But they form these sort of underwater meadows in the shallows. And they're basically just like havens for biodiversity because, you know, their leaves provide surfaces for algae and anemones to live on. They attract things like starfish and brittle stars and urchins and all sorts of sort of grazing mollusks, which then bring in things like crustaceans and, if you're lucky, top predators like octopus and things. So they're just these like, yeah, they're just incredible hotspots for biodiversity. The seagrasses grow all around Britain, all around the shores, but we've lost like 90% of our seagrass meadows. Half of that has been lost in the last century alone, but they do still exist all around the shores and very much need our protection. But yeah, if you're swimming in the shallows around Britain and you see this sort of almost like a meadow of grass under the water, then you're probably looking at seagrasses, which are so good.
Wow. And earlier you were talking about bladderwort, which I know the kind of bladder rack and seaweed. So I was like, is that a seaweed? Tell me a little bit more about seaweed, because seaweed is amazing to touch or even smell when it's kind of rotting on the beach, but it's so great to get or to pop it in your fingers like it's almost like bubble wrap. How many species of seaweed are there in the UK? Because there's so many beautiful different kinds and colours and textures.
So seaweeds are something, again, that I only really started learning about a couple of years ago. So seaweeds aren't actually technically plants. They are algae, but they're very closely related to the sort of group of algae that first gave rise to all land plants. But yeah, we have about 600 species of seaweed growing around Britain, and none of them are poisonous. So you can actually eat, and they're not all delicious, but none of them will poison you. So they're quite an easy way into the world of foraging. Some of them are absolutely extraordinary. But there are a couple of species that live way out sort of in the open ocean that very occasionally turn up on our shore, but they smell strongly of sulfur. So if you smell sulfur, maybe don't eat the seaweed, but otherwise they're pretty safe. But they, yeah, come in all sorts of different kinds. You've got the brown ones, the red ones, and the green ones. They all fall into those categories. So there's brown algae, red algae, and green algae. And species like bladderwrack, which are very, very common and have those, yeah, those little bladders that you can pop between your fingers. That's one of the brown algae. And I assume, yeah, the link there would be the little air-like bladders, which basically just keep it afloat when it's in the water so it can use the sunlight to photosynthesize. And then, yeah, I guess the link would be, yeah, the bladders with the bladder traps, although for a completely different function. But yeah, bladderwracks are a brilliant one. They're very, very common, easy to see. Sea lettuce is a very, very common one as well, which is like a very, very thin sheet, kind of almost like cling film, but like bottle green. And so you can hold it up to the lights and the sunlight will pass through it. It's all very beautiful. That one's really, really nice to eat. Yeah, I mean, there are so many different. My favorite seaweed is one called pepper dulse. Pepper dulse is tiny. It's like a few centimeters tall. It grows sort of, you only really see it at low tide because it grows right down and sort of the rock pools at the lowest tides. But it's extraordinary. It tastes, it looks a bit like a little tree, and it tastes like, it sounds ridiculous, but it tastes like mushrooms cooked in garlic butter, which sounds incredibly specific. But yeah, that is literally what it tastes like. And it is really quite extraordinary. So yeah, they're pretty cool seaweeds.
Yeah, they sound like, I've definitely touched sea lettuce because that's a good way to describe them, is like cling film. But I've not eaten it. So next time I go to Cornwall, I remember seeing a recipe book for all seaweed recipes in a shop there and having no idea that there was so much variety in how they would taste and the texture and what you could eat. I read that you can also have seaweed baths because apparently if you put them in water, they kind of release a special gel. But my friend said she tried it and stained the bathtub. So be warned before you try. You mentioned with seagrasses how much protection they need. And I'd love to talk a little bit about that, because one thing, of course, with getting up close with nature and learning more about it is then wanting to care for it. And I'd be really interested to know how more of us can do that. And also hear a little bit about your work with the Species Recovery Trust.
Yeah, so basically seagrasses suffer from issues like agricultural pollution, so stuff that's running off farm fields into rivers and then out into the sea, which if it's herbicides, it'll kill the plants. If it's fertilizers, then it adds loads of nitrogen and sort of nutrients into the system, which is really, really bad for those plants, and they can't really handle that. Yeah, so basically it causes loads of algae to grow really quickly, which then grows all over the leaves of the seagrass, blocking out the sunlight, and so makes them a lot weaker. They can then suffer from things like seagrass wasting disease, which is a real problem, particularly around Britain at the moment, which is basically, it's a disease caused by a protist, which is basically an organism that isn't a fungi, an animal, a plant, a bacteria. It's none of them. It's just its own group called protists. And yeah, it's one of these protists that causes this wasting disease. They also really suffer from things like dredging and disruption from sort of leisure boats in harbours and things, because, you know, propellers and things will tear through them and break up their leaves. So they're facing all sorts of challenges. The way we as individuals can support their regeneration is in two ways. The first is by supporting organizations like Project Seagrass, who are doing a lot of work to restore our seagrass meadows by sort of collecting seeds, growing them up in tanks into little plants, and then planting those back out again to give them sort of a head start. The sea wilding, which is up on the west coast of Scotland as well. But I think one of the best things we as individuals can do is basically talk about it with anyone we meet. So, you know, bring it up with your friends, just sort of raise awareness. And, you know, I, as a botanist, as someone who's been doing this for a long period of time, only really learned about seagrasses last year. So I didn't really know that we had massive underwater, well, not anymore, but we used to have these massive underwater meadows of seagrass. And I kind of figure if I haven't heard of that as someone who's been reading about plants for years, how can I expect my friends who aren't necessarily into nature to know about those? And obviously, if you don't know about something, you can't care about it and look after it. So just talking about it with other people is a really, really important thing. My work with the Species Recovery Trust is I'm sort of like a freelancer for them. So I'm good friends with Dominic Price, who set the whole thing up, and he's the director of the trust. And I basically lead courses for them. But their main sort of objective is to try and save 50 species from the brink of extinction in Britain before the year 2050. And they're doing all sorts of things, basically focusing on the rarest species that are, you know, they've got like one or two populations left, and they've gone under the radar at other bigger charities. And so they're kind of sweeping up all these things like, I don't know, like dwarf milkwort and starved sedge and all these kind of like, not, and it's not just plants either. There are things like New Forest cicada and various insects and things as well. So they've got this collection of very rare organisms that they're trying to give them sort of like a foot up in life and take them away from the brink of extinction to the point where they can sort of fend for themselves and their populations are robust enough to withstand, you know, environmental changes and things. But yeah, so a lot of their money comes from courses that they run. And so I run a few sort of plant identification courses for them. But yeah, we basically just go to a habitat like chalk grassland or heathland or something. And yeah, I just teach them how to identify the plants that can be found in those habitats.
Wow. Okay, that's wonderful. I'll definitely put a link in the show notes so people can check those out. And I think something that we have in common is that we clearly love to be very organized around our outdoor pursuits. Because I tried to swim in every tidal pool in Britain in a year, and you went around the country finding amazing plants. And I know before that, you went to find every orchid in Britain. And I think it's really a great way for people to engage with nature with setting themselves a challenge. If listeners were going to have a challenge around finding plants, photographing plants or wildflowers, do you have any suggestions of what they could do to spark their interest?
Ooh, that's a good question. I've never been asked that before. So my advice when people are starting to look for plants is basically to start on your doorstep, sometimes quite literally. As wonderful as nature reserves are, obviously by their very nature, they are full of species, or you'd hope they are anyway. And so actually going to these nice places can be very overwhelming when you're starting. So my first piece of advice would be to, yeah, start on your doorstep. You know, start, I don't know, it might be cracks in the pavement outside, or if you're lucky enough to have a garden, it might be species that are growing in the lawn. Look at those first, get to grips with those first. And then as you get confident with those, you can then work outwards and you have that then base to sort of work off. But my other piece of advice would be you can start with plant families. So yeah, groups of species that are closely related, yeah, get grouped into these families. So big ones in this country are things like the daisy family and the pea family, and they all share certain characteristics. And so a good way to start is just picking, say, I don't know, the 10 biggest plant families in the country and learning how to, you know, put a plant that you've got in front of you into one of those 10 categories. And if you can tick off things like daisy family, pea family, bedstraw family, if you're lucky enough, maybe orchid family, then yeah, it's a really, really good way to basically recognize what part of the book to look in when you find a plant, because then that immediately narrows it down. And rather than faced with thousands of species on hundreds of pages, you can immediately say, okay, this isn't this part of the book. I've just got 10 species that I have to look at instead of, you know, this great big book full of them. So yeah, I think if I was starting, that's probably what I would do, is set myself a challenge to find plants in 10 different plant families.
That's a really great suggestion. And I think something that you've encouraged me to do is to not just look for flowers. I saw your post the other day about kind of branches and buds along riverbanks. And actually, I don't think that buds is something I look enough at. And actually, you had, you know, purple, yellow, all these amazing colors. And that's a really good one for like having things in families as well.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people think that botany kind of goes on pause during the winter, but the trees in the winter, oh, they're just the best. And particularly on rivers, they're really, really colorful. So yeah, you know, willows can be all sorts of different colors, from red to sort of yellowy gold and all the way through to white. You've got alders, which have these beautiful purple buds. And yeah, there's so much color to be found in a winter landscape if you just look closely. And then, of course, you've got all sorts of things like mosses and liverworts, which absolutely love damp environments like riverbanks. And again, I think to a lot of people, a moss is just a moss. But when you look closely, they're so beautiful and they're all so different. And particularly when it's sunny and things, and when they're wet, they're just incredible to look at. And I think we miss so much joy and excitement and beauty in life just by not looking closely. And obviously, if you're in the water, looking at the riverbank is such a good way to see those things, because obviously you've got branches coming over the water. You can see things on the riverbank that you wouldn't be able to see from the towpath or the footpath. And being in the water is such a cool way to look at plants. I love it.
Yeah, and you're so right that we can't care for these things unless we know about them and we love them. So I'm just so passionate about more people discovering the delight in nature. And I can't recommend your book, Where the Wildflowers Grow, enough. It's just so beautiful and informative and joyous. And so I'll put a link in the show notes to that. But if there was one Instagram page, resource, YouTube channel, or charity or event series that you could recommend for people, what would it be?
Ooh, I think I would say the Botanical Society of Britain and Ireland. They're a small, really friendly charity who are basically, their sole purpose is to sort of collate records of all the plants that are growing wild in Britain and Ireland, to promote them and to promote their, so yeah, promote us protecting them and looking after them. They've got so many resources on how to start learning about plants. You know, they can put you in touch with your local experts, your local groups of botanists to go out looking for plants with. And they put on all sorts of events and have all sorts of resources for, you know, particular learning about particular groups of plants or knowing where to look or that sort of thing. So yeah, the Botanical Society of Britain and Ireland, that's BSBI for short, and they're on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and things.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me and for talking about your book and the wonderful plants and wildflowers to be found around our British waters.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
So that was Leif. I hope you enjoyed our chat. Definitely check out his Instagram for gorgeous photography and to learn lots about the outdoors. And you can follow the Species Recovery Trust for the talks and events that he mentioned. You can also buy Where the Wildflowers Grow wherever you get your books. Now, me and Leif are hoping to do an event together soon, so keep an eye on our social media channels for that, and I hope to see you there. Thanks again to this episode's sponsor, Try Hard. Say goodbye to chlorine and shop their skin and hair products at 15% off with the code TIDAL. See you at the next episode.